Welcome to Washington Today for October 25th, 2021. I'm Gary Starikoff. Thanks a lot for joining us this afternoon. Here are some headlines. Moderna has said that a low dose of its COVID-19 vaccine is safe and appears to work for kids under 12. Researchers tested two shots given a month apart, with each shot containing half the adult dose, and the initial results showed a strong immune response in kids aged 6 to 11. Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen told British lawmakers today that she thinks the social media giant stokes online hate, fails to protect children from harmful content, and lacks any incentive to fix the problems. And the Biden administration has issued new international COVID-19 air travel policies starting on November 8th. International travelers to the U.S. will need to be fully vaccinated, with limited exceptions, and all travelers will need to be tested before getting on an airplane. But we begin in London, where Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen told a British House of Commons committee that the social media company's algorithms help to amplify online hate by pushing people with mainstream interests to the extremes. Here's Q&A between Frances Haugen and Joint Committee Chair Damien Collins.
Looking at the way the platform is moderated today, do you think it, unless there is change, do you think it makes it more likely that we will see events like the insurrection in Washington on the 6th of January this year, more violent acts that have been driven by Facebook systems? Do you think it's more likely we will see more of those events as things stand today?
I have no doubt that the events we're seeing around the world, things like Myanmar and Ethiopia, those are the opening chapters, because engagement-based ranking does two things. One, it prioritizes and amplifies divisive, polarizing, extreme content, and two, it concentrates it. And so if Facebook comes back and says, only a tiny sliver of content on our platform is hate, or only a tiny sliver is violence, one, they can't detect it very well, so I don't know if I trust those numbers. But two, it gets hyper-concentrated in, 5% of the population. And you only need 3% of the population on the streets to have a revolution, and that's dangerous.
Frances Haugen and British House of Commons Joint Committee Chair Damien Collins. In her testimony, Ms. Haugen said that she is worried about Facebook's ability to make its Instagram app safe for kids and teenagers. She talked about that with Scottish National Party MP John Nicholson.
You've already told the Senate, and you've also told us what Facebook could do to address some of these issues. But some of your answers were quite complicated.
Oh, no. Sorry.
So perhaps you could tell us in a really simple way that anybody can get what Facebook could do to address those issues. Children who want to kill themselves, children who are being bullied, children who are obsessed with their body image in an unhealthy way, and all the other issues that you've addressed. But what is it that Facebook can do now without difficulty to solve those issues?
There are a number of factors that interplay that drive those issues. On a most basic level, children don't have as good self-regulation as adults do. That's why they're not allowed to buy cigarettes. When kids describe their usage of Instagram, Facebook's own research describes it as an addict's narrative. As an addict's narrative. The kids say, this makes me unhappy. I feel like I don't have the ability to control my usage of it. And I feel that if I left, I'd be ostracized. I am deeply worried that it may not be possible to make Instagram safe for a 14-year-old, and I sincerely doubt it's possible to make it safe for a 10-year-old.
So they shouldn't be on it?
I would be surprised. I would love to see a proposal from an established independent agency that had a picture of what a safe version of Instagram for a 14-year-old looks
like. You don't think such a thing exists?
I am not aware of something that
does. Does Facebook care whether or not Instagram is safe for a 10-year-old?
What I find very deeply misleading about Facebook's statements regarding children is they say things like, we need Instagram kids because kids are going to lie about their age, and so we might as well have a safe thing for them. Facebook should have to publish what they do to detect 13-year-olds on the platform, because I guarantee you what they're doing today is not enough. And Facebook's own research does something where Facebook can guess how old you are with a great deal of precision. because they can look at who your friends are, who you interact with.
Because you're at school.
Yeah,
because that's a bit of a giveaway. Oh, if you're wearing a school uniform, chances are you're on 20.
But I want to disclose a very specific thing. This is something actually the Senate found when we disclosed the documents to them. They found that Facebook had estimated the ages of teenagers and worked backwards to figure out how many kids lied about their ages and how many were on the platform. And they found for some cohorts, 10 to 15% of 10-year-olds were on the platform. Facebook should have to publish those stats every year so we can grade how good were they at keeping kids off the platform.
Q&A between British House of Commons member John Nicholson and whistleblower Frances Haugen. Frances Haugen was a product manager of Facebook for nearly 2 years. Her job was to track the spread of information on the platform. She testified to a Senate committee last month, and in the coming weeks, she is scheduled to meet with officials in France, Germany, and the European Union. Here's more from her Q&A with John Nicholson.
But what your evidence has shown to us is that Facebook is failing to prevent harm to children. It's failing to prevent the spread of disinformation. It's failing to present hate speech. It does have the power to deal with these issues. It's just choosing not to, which makes me wonder whether Facebook is just fundamentally evil. Is Facebook evil?
I cannot see into the hearts of men. And I think there is a real thing of good people, and Facebook is overwhelmingly full of conscientious, kind, empathetic people.
You have to
good
leave.
Good people who are embedded in systems with bad incentives are led to bad actions. Mm-hmm. And there is a real pattern of people who are willing to look the other way are promoted more than people who raise alarms.
Mm-hmm. We know where that leads in history.
Yeah.
Don't we? So could we compromise that it's not evil? Maybe that's an overly moralistic word. But the way that some of the outcomes of Facebook's behavior is evil.
I think it's negligent.
Malevolent?
Malevolent implies intent, and I cannot see into the hearts of men. But I do believe there is a pattern of inadequacy, that Facebook is unwilling to acknowledge its own power. It believes in a world of flatness, which hides the difference. Like, children are not adults, right? They believe in flatness, and they won't accept the consequences of their actions. And so I think that is negligence, and it is ignorance. But I can't see into their hearts, and so I don't want to consider it malevolent.
Well, I respect your desire, obviously, to answer the question in your own way. But given the evidence that you've given us, I think a reasonable person running Facebook, seeing the consequences of the company's behaviour, would, I imagine, have to conclude that what they were doing, the way their company was performing, and the outcomes were malevolent and would want to do something about it.
I would certainly hope so.
Frances Haugen and Scottish National Party MP John Nicholson in the British House of Commons earlier today. You can find the entire hearing on our website at cspan.org. The link is right on our homepage. Representatives from Facebook and other social media companies plan to speak to the British committee on Thursday. Back here in the U.S., President Biden says he feels good about the prospects of his Build Back Better plan getting through Congress following his meeting with West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer at his house in Delaware on Sunday.
Well, a few more things to work out, but it went well.
Do you think you'll have a plan before Wednesday?
With the grace of God and the goodwill of neighbors.
Do you want a plan, a deal by the time you leave for COP? Is that something you've expressed to Democrats?
That's my hope.
Do you expect to vote this week?
What do you think? I don't know.
We're asking you.
Are you concerned if you have to leave without your...
It'd be very, very positive to get it done before the trip. Thank you.
Thank you.
Democrats are working intensely to wrap up talks on the bill, scaling back what had been a sweeping $3.5 trillion plan. Here's Senator Schumer saying more about the meeting in his leader time remarks on the Senate floor.
Now, Madam President, on Build Back Better. We had a productive weekend as we continue to close in on a final agreement for President Biden's Build Back Better plan. Yesterday morning, I traveled to Delaware to meet with the President and Senator Manchin about our agenda. It was a very good meeting, and I thank the President for his leadership. And I also thank my colleagues in both chambers for their shared commitment to getting this consequential and desperately needed legislation across the finish line. No one ever said passing transformational legislation like this would be easy, but we are on track to get this done because it's so important, and it is what the American people need and what they want. The progress of last week illustrated if we stick together, work towards finding that legislative sweet spot, then we can get big things done for the American people.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. And during his leader time remarks, Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell talked about his opposition to the bill.
The biggest tax hikes in 50 years, the biggest peacetime tax hikes ever recorded in American history. That is what Washington Democrats are cooking up. Our Democratic colleagues and President Biden are behind closed doors dreaming up creative new ways to grab literally historic amounts of the American people's money. Remember, the same socialist spending plans that Democrats claim cost $0 somehow also need staggering new tax hikes to pay for them. So even with significant inflation, runaway gas prices, and runaway energy costs already hitting American families in their pocketbooks, Washington Democrats have spent months dreaming up new cash grabs for the IRS. Democrats have talked about massively hiking business taxes to a level that would leave American industries paying more than their competitors in communist China. They've talked about jacking up marginal income tax rates in ways that would hammer small businesses and family businesses that file as pass-throughs. They've talked about adding a second death tax to give the IRS an even bigger bite out of family farms. They've even promised something that our country has never seen before, a new IRS surveillance dragnet where the IRS would get to track ordinary citizens' inflows and outflows. Banks and credit unions would be forced to hand over Americans' private information to the IRS. The Democrats are so desperate to shake down the American people for money that they're proposing to essentially treat everybody, like they're under audit. For months now, our Democratic colleagues have been toying with one staggering tax increase after another.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier today. With more, here's Politico's Nicholas Wu.
Well, based on the White House's readout of the meeting, it seems that they had productive conversations, and it's really going towards this goal that congressional Democrats have set of reaching some sort of deal on this, passing this infrastructure bill and reaching some sort of framework, agreement, and principle on the social spending bill by October 31st or Halloween. And so it looks like they made progress towards that, and we're really seeing right now some of this last-minute horse trading and deal-making that will make it possible to get this through.
What does the deal look like right now?
That's still very much in flux. Some of these big proposals that look like they might have been dropped from the plan, like family leave, for example, Speaker Pelosi indicated yesterday on one of the Sunday shows that it was going to stay in. Or SALT, for example, looks like it might stay in the deal. Other things like free community college, as we know, haven't dropped out.
What is the price tag?
We don't know. Senator Manchin has repeatedly indicated that he will not accept a bill larger than $1.5 trillion. But right now, a lot of progressive Democrats seem that they're more willing to accept a bill closer to $2 trillion. So, there's about half $1 trillion of wiggle room that needs to be negotiated there.
What is the plan to get this through the Senate, through the House, and on the president's desk?
That's very tricky. But the thing is with the Senate, the main goal of all this outreach here has been to try to get these two moderate senators on board, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who have, you know, laid out their own list of demands for what they want and don't want in these bills. And with that, you know, Democrats should be able to achieve unity among all 50 in the Senate. The trickier problem is the 200-some Democrats in the House, where you have any number of different constituencies, many of whom it's been their life's goal, actually, to put a lot of these kinds of programs in the bill. And if any one of these programs, family medical leave, SALT, and so on, that has been declared a red line by some of these constituencies in Congress becomes an issue, it could make it much harder to get through the House.
What is happening with the bipartisan infrastructure deal, the one that includes the hard infrastructure, roads, bridges, it passed in the Senate? When will that see a vote on in the House?
Well, congressional leaders are aiming to hold a vote on it this week. The highway authorization overall actually expires on the 31st. So in some way, Democrats have a hard deadline for themselves to pass this infrastructure bill, which would, of course, renew the highway funding and, you know, authorize nearly $1 trillion for infrastructure. At the same time, progressive Democrats have avowed, as they have all along, that there needs to be some sort of agreement on the social spending bill before they can proceed to a vote on the infrastructure bill. And, you know, one thing can't happen without the other, and this is the very tricky balancing act that leaders in Congress have to work with right now.
There is also the issue of the debt ceiling. They were able to get agreement with Republicans for a short-term fix. What did they do, and what happens next?
So the debt ceiling was extended until the beginning of December, yes, through that kind of short-term fix that they had worked out with Republicans. But Republicans don't seem like they're going to support another extension of it after that. So one option that's on the table for Democrats is to use that that so-called fast-track process of reconciliation. Now, whether or not they will do that, you know, remains to be seen, especially given that it can be a kind of lengthy and drawn-out and sometimes painful process for them to execute.
Politico's Nicholas Wu from this morning's Washington Journal program. You can see more at cspan.org/WJ. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more headlines. Moderna announced that a low dose of its COVID-19 vaccine is safe and appears to work for kids under 12. Researchers tested two shots given a month apart. Each shot contained half the adult dose, with initial results showing a strong immune response. The study involved 4,753 children aged 6 to 11 who either got the vaccine or dummy shots, with data showing an immune response up to 1.5 times as high as what has been seen in adults. Now, the study is still going on, and Moderna says it hasn't been peer-reviewed, but it plans to share the interim results with the FDA soon. And this news comes following Friday's announcement from Pfizer that kid-sized doses of its vaccine also appear safe for 5 to 11-year-olds. White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci says vaccines for kids could be available next month.
I would think so, George. You never want to get ahead of the FDA in their regulatory decisions, nor do you want to get ahead of the CDC and their advisors on what the recommended would be. But if you look at the data that's been made public and announced by the company, the data look good as to the efficacy and the safety. The FDA and their advisory committee will be meeting next week on October the 26th. And then their regulatory decision will be handed over to the CDC, likely November 2nd or 3rd. So if all goes well and we get the regulatory approval and the recommendation from the CDC, it's entirely possible, if not very likely, that vaccines will be available for children from 5 to 11 within the first week or two of November.
White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday on ABC News This Week. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis announced plans to offer unvaccinated officers from other states $5,000 bonuses to relocate and join the police force in Florida. Governor DeSantis told Fox News host Maria Bartiromo that it's part of an effort to fill open positions in local police and sheriff's departments. But at an event today, he said his plan to offer the bonuses has nothing to do with vaccine mandates.
No. It's for officers, period. It has nothing to do with their vaccination status. So that's just wrong. That's a bad. I think there was a headline from a corporate outlet, which we all know corporate media lies. Okay, they do not tell the truth. Assume what they tell you is false, and then figure out why they're telling you a false narrative. I put that out there as a proposal months ago, and the reason we're doing it is because people are being treated poorly in Seattle, in Minnesota, and New York NYPD. They don't have the support. They've had their funding cut. They get criticized if they just enforce the law. Some places they don't even enforce the law, like in San Francisco. They don't prosecute people shoplifting, so you have rampant crime. So that's why we're doing it, because morale is low. Morale is low for years because of how law enforcement's been treated. But when you saw all the rioting last summer, all the vitriol directed at them, Florida stood up and said, we back the blue. And so we are 100% excited about saying anyone that's being mistreated, if the morale's low, if you can't take that environment, and we have openings here, you're going to get an environment where people are going to support you. And I think that's something that's, and I can tell you the people that have come down from some of these places already, you talk to them, it's the best decision they've ever made. So we're looking to capitalize off a lot of communities across our country who have turned their back on law enforcement, who aren't providing them the support, where there's all kinds of different problems with just being able to do the job. So it has nothing to do, it will be available to anyone who comes. And so if people are trying to say it's a vaccine issue, it's not, has nothing to do with that. They've been mistreated for a long time. I don't think a police officer should be fired over shots. I don't think that's correct. They've been out in the line. They've been out for months, a year and a half, 2 years doing their job. And we said that they were heroes for a while. And now all of a sudden some jurisdictions want to fire them. I think that's wrong for sure. But our $5,000 bonus, that applies to anyone. I mean, you know, if you're in NYPD and you're not getting the support you need and you're qualified, you come down here, you're going to get a bonus because we've got your back, and it's a way to say thank you, just like we did with the $1,000 bonuses that we gave for every sworn law enforcement officer in last year's budget as a way to say thank you. While other jurisdictions were defunding police, we were funding them and then doing bonuses. So we're going to continue to do that. We're also going to have a proposal to increase pay for the state law enforcement agency so we can make sure we keep folks there, and then that's competitive.
Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. A week before the Global Summit on Climate Change, a new report shows that greenhouse gas pollution has hit a record high last year, despite the COVID-19 lockdowns. The report by the UN's World Meteorological Organization shows that carbon dioxide levels surged in 2020 to 4.132 million parts per million. That's higher than the annual average over the last decade and is far above the Paris Agreement pollution reduction targets. The report goes on to say that staying at or above that pollution level will have major negative effects on our daily lives and well-being both now and in the near future. The UN's COP26 meetings are scheduled to start on Sunday in Glasgow, Scotland. Leaders from 200 countries will be there, including President Biden, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping are expected to make video appearances. Jury selection got underway today in U.S. District Court in Charlottesville, Virginia, in the civil case against the organizers and participants of 2017's Unite the Right rally. 9 people injured at the 2-day event have filed a lawsuit alleging physical harm and emotional distress at the rally, during which a counter-protester was killed and dozens more when a man injured when a man intentionally drove his car into the crowd. According to a Washington Post report, the plaintiffs are alleging the event was part of a conspiracy to engage in racially motivated violence. Their attorneys reportedly intend to use a Reconstruction-era law that was intended to protect emancipated African Americans from the Ku Klux Klan. The defendants are some of the most notorious white supremacist and neo-Nazi figures in the U.S. The Post reported that some of them are expected to testify during the trial. 3-term Maryland Democratic Congressman Anthony Brown said on Monday he will step down at the end of his term to run for state attorney general. Representative Brown is seeking to replace 2-term incumbent Democrat Brian Frosch, who said last week he would retire in 2022. Representative Brown is a former Maryland state legislator and lieutenant governor. His seat is likely to remain in Democratic hands. Former Prince George's County State's Attorney Glenn Ivey, who lost to Brown in the 2016 Democratic primary, has already said he will run again. The U.S. Embassy in Sudan is advising U.S. citizens there to shelter in place following a coup in the country. In a security alert posted on Monday, the embassy said it has received reports that armed forces are blocking certain areas in and around the capital of Khartoum and that internet service there is down. The warning comes after military leaders there seized power early on Monday, arresting the prime minister and other officials and dissolving the transitional government. Protesters opposing the coup have taken to the streets in Khartoum. Some face gunfire near the military's headquarters, according to the information industry, with three people killed and 80 more wounded, according to the Sudan Doctors Committee. The takeover comes more than 2 years after protesters forced the ouster of longtime autocrat Omar al-Bashir, and just weeks before the military was supposed to hand over control of the country to a civilian council. At today's State Department briefing, spokesman Ned Price talked about the situation in Sudan.
A couple of practical questions on Sudan. Does the United States have an idea on the whereabouts of Prime Minister Hamdok?
We have not been in touch with the Prime Minister. We have not been in touch.
Can you verify the casualty numbers that's been out there?
We've seen the reports that of the use of live fire. As we said, violence on the part of the regime is something we condemn in the strongest terms. The regime must not resort to violence against peaceful protesters. The right of peaceful assembly is something that we defend, that we protect, that we promote the world over, whether that's Khartoum or anywhere else. So again, we have made very clear where we stand. There needs to be a return to the civilian-led transitional government. The military is responsible for the health and the safety of the prime minister and the others in their custody. The military must not resort to violence. Peaceful assembly, the right of peaceful assembly, must be protected. And again, a full restoration of the civilian-led government is what we are supporting. It's what the people of Sudan aspire to as well.
Quick ones. Have you gotten in touch with the military, or is someone from the U.S. side in any way in communication with the military?
So we have been in close touch with partners and allies, both in the region and well beyond. We are very closely coordinated. Our messaging, our approach, our actions vis-a-vis what we've seen transpire in Sudan over the past 16 hours or so, with our partners, friends, and allies in the region and well beyond. And if it would be constructive for us to be in touch with actors, including elements of the military in Sudan, we would do that. But I'm not going to read out any of those overtures or diplomatic conversations.
State Department spokesman Ned Price. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the coup and called for the release of the prime minister and other officials. He said in a tweet today that the UN would continue to stand with the people of Sudan. And a reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it on our new C-SPAN Now app at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington delivered right to your inbox, you can subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterikoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.